Welcome to Subject, Object, Verb. Today's episode is an audio lecture from the artist and writer Mochu, who I first encountered at the Sharjah Biennial when we were showing some work right next to each other. His video, which was called Cool Memories of Remote Gods, was a wild fractal of visuals set against his soothing voice depicting a reality of forking possibilities. Mochu describes his narratives as technofictions, and they tend to be highly referential, dropping ideas from novelists, philosophers, and artists. In this episode, Mochu creates an audio variation of his recent book, Nervous Fossils, Syndromes of the Synthetic Neither. The book is a narrative based in the Persian Gulf at an art free port, which is a large warehouse where art can be held tax-free, almost as if the art exists in no country at all. It's a peculiar tomb where culture disappears. The recent film Tenet includes a cortisol-pumping depiction of freeports. Mochu's book hops across numerous locations, both real and imagined. It discusses what he describes as shadow histories of synthetic color, nuclear warning signs, and syndromes that travel in time. It drifts between essay and fiction and mythology. In the book, the Freeport designers gradually begin to discuss the monumental works of art pleasantly rotting around them. They consider deep time, volcanoes, planktons, fossils, robot historians, and rich technocrats. Art becomes a mediating entity for the limitations of human experience. The excerpts that you'll hear today begin with the origin of the Dubai Freeport from a discovery of extinct fish in the Comoros Islands in Africa. And then it spins out from there. This is a wild abstraction of sound and ideas. Enjoy.
Fossils always had their cameo moments in the Comoros Islands. After an increase in recorded live specimens of the ancient coelacan species, once thought to be extinct, the islands attracted a sizable number of fossil bounty hunters. The anthropologist encountered an entire informal network of them in the islands, a restless, scheming shoal of odd specialists, their minds constantly parsing through the bureaucracies of deep time. The shoal had become enamored with a whole nest of rumors, including news about various previously unknown ecosystems developing around this part of the Indian Ocean, leading to cross-oceanic hacker coalitions targeting dinosaur bone markets and darknet trade competition among fossil fetish communities. The collusion of big mafia money and the fragile technical precision required to bring together paleontological data with international trade restrictions made the shoal a rather odd mix of fuzzy scientists, failed academicians, and shady businessmen with unclear credentials and dubious passports. The trail was long. Most fossils traveled farther and more convoluted paths than their live bodies ever did. Mafia groups, film actors, billionaire celebrities, that's where these integrated lithocellular archives ended up. A layer of cartilaginous undead, subtly finding its niche within worldwide financial operations and transnational trade routes. The hotels and pools, the beaches and advertisements, the typically cheap plastic flex vinyl color sprouting all over the volcanic archipelago, appeared to the anthropologist a new kind of vegetation, fertilized by planetary-scale technopollen. Enormous machinic mating trails actualized across oceans and mountains. Yet in spite of the heavy infrastructural transformations around, and perhaps due to some unusual impulse for demographic protectionism on part of the island state, none of the beneficiaries of the recent citizenship program actually got permission to migrate and physically reside in their newly granted country. As much as could be made out at the moment, most of the new passport holders had become involuntary nomads, neither based in their original homeland nor in Comoros, with most investments in the islands faltering on the edge of complete failure. freshly acquired mobility became a novel form of imprisonment, mandating them to keep on the lookout for a third elsewhere country to be in. The islands, meanwhile, like most neoliberal fantasies, morphed into a purgatorial ruin of dusty resorts, unserviced passenger airplanes, and empty tourism rituals, peppered with extreme unemployment and rising prices. Ideas for the Dubai Freeport emerged somewhere in the midst of this plastic swamp. In its prenatal form, it was actually a lab, simply known as the facility in the days that the anthropologists first heard about it. In fact, the first thing the anthropologists heard about it was regarding its anticipated shutdown. Some biochemical research there had apparently initiated controversies. Located in one of the farther islands in the archipelago, it was a freshly painted, unremarkable building from the outside. Something that would pass for a local pathology clinic normally. True to the journalistic spirit of the century, the controversies reported were suspenseful and mysterious, with a good dose of conspiratorial components. The most dramatic part of the stories was right at the beginning, the so-called lamprey attack on divers last year off the coast. For the record, lampreys have never been known to harm humans. Infestations of the fish in large numbers are commonly known to clog rivers and dams or drainages in urban centers. But being small parasites that suck blood off fish and other aquatic creatures, they are not known to have any interest in larger animals, much less a land mammal. However, lampreys have remained quite a staple in pop horror stories, possibly because of the structure of their jawless mouth. At one end of their eel-like body is a dark cavity with a circular cluster of teeth, combined with a suction mechanism at the opening of this cavity for parasitic blood extraction. The animal lends itself well to a decent creature feature. Regardless, the Comoros incident was no attack. A living fossil was involved still, an extant species of lamprey that was previously unknown, but shared characteristics with the extinct types. The discovery being recent, no corresponding protection plan had yet been drafted to ascertain the species' endangered status. Soon there was a swift inflow of groups from all over the world. Scientists, biologists, environmentalists, paleontologists and investors to study the fish. Perhaps due to the fish's similarity with extinct breeds, fossil smuggling schemes revived too, sneaking through the loose research initiatives taking shape. But as for research itself, the central focus was on the skin pigmentation of the lampreys. The facility had hosted a lot of covert aspects of the same research, possibly related to military or space technology applications of the lamprey skin. Its color was a peculiarly intense black that was darker in value than the densest black available industrially. Further examinations were required to ascertain the exact nature of pigmentation, as well as the ultrastructural formations within which it might be embedded. In what seemed an opportunistic move at the time, some private entities from Dubai invested a significant sum into the facility and its classified research, although the anthropologists later understood that their particular interest in it had a more metaphysical inclination than their Western counterparts. Since Gulf investments in the archipelago had become common for a few years now, this minor investment step into a discreet biochemical lab escaped all media attention. The pigmentation research, in any case, explained the diver attack mystery. What the commercial divers had encountered during their expedition was quite simply a dense shoal of black lampreys. The black being so intense, it had impaired all visibility, generating a temporary sheet of perfect lightlessness, causing excessive panic and eventual heart failure in one of the divers in the group. The incident was at the time widely reported in local Shikomori newspapers, albeit not without a mild Lovecraftian flavor. While research at the facility continued, the controversies raged on. at the heart of which lay the mysterious syndrome Ziferath. The logo of the Dubai Freeport was a circular Ouroboros-like lamprey, eating its own tail, with a gradient neon red near the head and fading into a rich black by the tail tip. A dramatic 3D animation of the logo launched its corporate extensions, which resembled an alien xenomorph more than a tiny water parasite, with a sinister disc of sharp teeth that would cantilever menacingly out of the head cavity. Its first material appearance was at the Disconnection Conference in Dubai, set in a sprawling luxury hotel on the outskirts. The hotel itself was only recently completed and therefore empty of any occupants. Inside were freshly imported synthetic tropical landscapes ingeniously combined with local vegetation, while right outside the hotel was a grid of giant cranes, a few lonely skyscrapers still in the make, and an adjacent web of expressways drowning in construction dust, leading far into the desert. The logo's presence at the conference was rather muted despite its foreboding techno-sigil attitude. There were no banners, no gaudy advertising around, just the conference members themselves milling around the lobby and the lawns, carrying some regular branding stuff like laptop bags, cups, pens, and other similar merchandise. The conference remains the singular event that brought together all the ideas that made the Dubai Freeport such a remarkable design exercise. The Syndrome Ziferath, the design team and the robot historians converged in the conference gardens. The empty luxury hotel could have seemed a bit like the Overlook Hotel or maybe like the palace in Marienbad. Tropical vegetation overflowed. Moss, palms, creepers, water streams and volcanic soil, conditioned at times within glass fullerene domes, elsewhere out in the open. There were even big birds with colourful wings, dragonflies, crickets and spiders. The authentic and the trash mingled unabashedly. It was both joke and marvel. No Abusian twins, no corpses debauching about the freshly furnished tropical gloss, yet the vast domes and the humid botany was central to Syndrome Ziferath in the same antipodal way that shadowless gardens of Marienbad or the preternaturally lit bar and overlook stood for certain regions of the mind. Memories, ideas and thoughts were intricately connected to material artifacts and spatial arrangements. The robot historians seem to have traveled far from the distant future. Across 13.8 billion years, these machinic descendants had found ways to retrieve information from humans and historicize it in accordance with their own temporal schema. Were they even robots anyways? Which was something the conference attendees ruminated about during their frequent smoke breaks. There appeared to be some trace of technology in them, as humans understand technology now. Yet these historians seemed powered on an entirely other code of being. Experientially, the most uncanny aspect was that their attendance at the conference did not even feel like a presence. It was more like a definitive knowledge of them being around, somewhat like convictions and dreams. Only that convictions and dreams felt more slippery and mutable at any instant, unlike the intensely visceral material sharpness here. And it was possible to enter and exit this influential emptiness in tandem with the conference discussions. The phrase itself came up spontaneously, because the robot historians, being fully active in the future, could not possibly be present in the actual present. But they could effectuate change in the present, a retrogressive transmission of effects, a peculiar kind of absence that could wield substantially detailed influence on the present. Had the lucidity and precision of information exchange not been so incredible, this would have been comparable to a seance. Not without a peculiar twist, though. It felt as if the historians weren't the ones visiting the past, but the conference members were being summoned 13.8 billion years ahead. These emptiness-inflected meetings made them feel like ghosts in some future Sion session, their deaths already accounted for in some covert temporal register. Even the breaks had begun to look endless. Cigarettes burned slow, never really finishing. Unknown spectrums of light shimmering at their tips. The present was being transported losslessly into the future. Historical time wavered oddly on exposure to certain substances, realized the robot historians. From their distant frontiers, the waste isolation pilot plant site in New Mexico might even have assumed a mirage-like quality. Starting in the 1970s, various trials were initiated to develop disposal solutions for nuclear waste by the U.S. Department of Energy. It was perhaps being realized then for the first time that nuclear waste decay could take up to 24,000 years, and it was impossible to tell whether civilization or language would survive that many years. The waste buried miles beneath the desert of New Mexico, like in many other similar sites, would continue to remain toxic till nuclear decay is complete. Therefore, it would have to remain necessarily inaccessible, or at least be warned against, under all circumstances. Several groups were assembled, comprised of artists, anthropologists, semioticians, and architects, to develop potential warning signs that would deter or caution any emergent forms of intelligence against attempting to access the underground sites. But what kind of warning signs would continue to hold meaning past the disappearance of all known language? After many iterations, the Sandia National Laboratories submitted a report selecting the design ideas of artists Safdar Abidi and Michael Brill. These were geoglyph illustrations mostly, utilitarian land art sketches drowned in doomsday naturalism. A field of spiky, towering thorns was one. Another showed extruded solid concrete, painted black, covering the entire ground surface. All these ideas, curiously, were oriented towards a view from above. They preempted grand, totalizing gazes, artfully contemplating ancestral puzzles from a universal vantage point. The rejects and shortlists went a lot more speculative, proposing a nuclear priesthood that would keep disseminating myths that survive over generations, or genetically modified cats that would change color if they were to go close to the toxic site. Abandoned in between all that bureaucratic talk was also an oddly intertextual addition. On top of the black earthworks was to be etched Edvard Munch's classic painting, The Scream. The idea was to have simplified cartoon-like versions of the screaming face distributed across the site. Some recent readings of The Scream claim that the fiery orange sky surrounding the screaming figure is actually the depiction of an evening colored with volcanic dust from the Krakatoa eruption in Sumatra. Unusually red twilight glows were reported to have appeared in Norway from late November 1883 through the middle of February 1884. On one of his walks during the time, Munch was overwhelmed with emotion when he felt a great, unending scream pierce through nature. In the image painted 10 years later, in 1893, the screaming figure releases the subterranean acoustic force of incredible intensity. Sulfur aerosols, obsidian dust, and fenocris are disseminated as pyroclastic metadata of the painting. The synesthetic chemistry here is uncanny. The event happens at a great distance, far in Indonesia, unseen, yet is absorbed sonically. Not as sound itself, but as piercing color. Experienced like a haunting, without ever seeing the actual event, the scream is unending, perpetual, it obeys no time. Sensed both as a premonition and lag, a strange horror erupts. Shrapnel of the past, arriving late, makes even the present appear distant, like a sad ruin. About a century later, Pynchon Slothrop embodies a similar reversal. When he can feel them coming days in advance. But it's a reflex. A reflex to something that's in the air right now. A regulatory valve for bargaining the terms of human extinction. The screen proposed at the New Mexico site is a recalibration of the same metaphors. Industrial nuclear waste is also of subterranean marination, a deathly silent, dormant poison buried deep in the earth, but manifesting as an imploded burial, in contrast to the exploding volcanic interior that flies out into space with deafening noise. There is also a reciprocity of signs. The painted volcanic sky spills through the rubbery stretching mouth of the lonesome figure on the bridge below, while the nuclear waste sends jarring visual alarms blaring back into the sky. The scream, precipitous, thin and frenzied, is also slow, heavy and ancient. Munch's uncompromising vision inspired the conference quite a bit. The molten mouth oozed through the greenery, lava saliva collecting around the dozing conference members. The stupor seemed endless, lit by the gentle, glowing swell of magma. In the same key, as if in a dream, dry practicalities emerged, taking count of the numerous works of art stored away in different parts of the world. The most obvious case study was the gossip-ridden Freeport in Geneva, with around 1 million artworks in its storage, the biggest one in the world. The scale might make it seem the largest art museum in the world, except that time behaves quite differently in a Freeport. The circulation of the stored artworks is entirely computational, as there is almost no physical movement of artworks once they enter the structure. The relative autonomy from national taxes makes the Freeport's art operations solely oriented towards highly contingent financial commands. The artworks rapidly accelerate into the future, while cardinally sealing the present away. Museums, on the contrary, prevent their artifacts from being corroded by the momentum of the future. There the past is undisturbed and monumental, carefully pickled in all its atmospherics. Back in the early days, mythological memories of arcs and vaults had dominated the initial conversations about the Freeport. But the designers soon figured that the case at hand was different. This was no transitory storage space anticipating a messianic closure for its finite insurances. The insuring itself was becoming integrated permanently into the value of the work. Or in other words, the calculation of future risk was overriding all the known potentialities inherent in the artworks. In addition, unlike other existing Freeports, the team here had counted in and quantified all known immaterial practices as well. Gestures, actions, temporarily imagined colors, practical jokes, digestion, hallucinated voices, cold sweat, data breach failures, decay, preserved animals, erased graffiti, sleep,
degrees of generation loss in transfer digital files,
illegal restoration, deja vu. The list extended over many pages. Exemption from customs rules and taxation means that once an artwork enters a Freeport, there is practically no safer place for it to be. Taking it out is expensive and risky. The value of the artwork then hinges on this risk and the insurance against it. Any exposure to anything becomes a risk for the artwork, to exhibitions, biennials, auctions, museums, or even to humans. How would it be to trade on a hallucination without a subject? Or the fluctuating market price of a unique panic attack? What would be the ideal payment gateway for it? The present, in its entirety, falls into crisis when pegged to an algorithmic future, constantly recalibrated against contingency. It might even be considered to disintegrate in the process, or eaten away. The future, then, is a currency in its own right. A currency that can replace anything, a substitute for all the errors of the past and the ongoing present. More fundamentally, as the Freeport design is realized, the future becomes a chemical power that can transpose, confuse, and stand in for all organic and inorganic realms. The recognition echoed Marx's observations on the universality of money itself, its fundamentally material nature. Even Kazimir Malevich, despite his resistance to Soviet materialism, implies the same thing with his chemical conversion of dead bodies into black powder through the application of heat. Black Square is a futurist chemical gathered at the pharmacist's shelf, the future that can potentially trade for anything that lies within time. The tiniest of material ruins are in this manner intertwined with eternity. By design then, a precisely realized freeport would be a containment spectrally airlocked to seal away human perception and consciousness. Although the artworks would still continue to exist for an indefinite amount of time, making them repositories for the storage of the future, a future that is again crucially on lockdown. And consequently, it is not only the trading on existing artworks that are implicated here, but also the production of new artworks. New artworks would be pure speculation itself, a kind of craft of relaying updates of the future so minutely and constantly that the overlap of the present with the future would be accurate, with exact predictive coordinates in place and the risk itself minimized to zero. But the question remained whether it would be advisable to rely on human labor for advancing the speculative program to its fullest extent. In as far as art is understood as a cognitive technology, it is highly possible that humans are only episodically involved in its propagation or storage. Once intelligence relocates itself outside of the human cognitive apparatus, art might as well shift its base too. And this is exactly what the Dubai Freeport wanted to be: a place to store and trade artworks that would have nothing to do with humans. The designers considered the instruments of finance a part of the overall technical field that would constitute the final divergence of humans away from their current organic limits. Very much in the vein of the Russian Biocosmos program, they held the view that the human body is a tax that is being paid systematically to credit the account of death. A truly tax-free zone should ideally keep out any involvement with such an unsustainable organic debt. Implicit in financial operations too was this clandestine taste in body horror, in the splatter and gore involved in the evacuation of bodies from events.
Thank you for listening to Subject Object Verb. Today's episode was recorded by Abhishek Mathur at Quarternote Studios. Nervous Fossils, Syndromes of the Synthetic Nether is published in India by Kiran Nadar Museum of Art and Reliable Copy. Arrangement and mix by Suvani Suri. Today's music was composed by me. As always, feel free to reach out to us at subjectobjectverb@artreview.com and describe your most memorable experience inside of a freeport.